Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It is 6 a.m. in Shanghai, 8 a.m. in Sydney, and 6 p.m. here in Atlanta. I'm Linda Kincaid, in for Julia Chatterley. And wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. A very warm welcome to First Move. Here is your need to know. Widespread pro-Palestinian protests at U.S. colleges. Flashpoints at the University of Texas at Austin, where several protesters are zip-tied and pulled away. Students defy deadlines to leave an encampment at Columbia University in New York. In the Middle East, Hamas is considering a proposal to release at least 20 Israeli hostages in exchange for a pause in the fighting. And fighting for a better Africa. How leaders across the continent from nearly 20 countries are working to deliver sustainable growth. We'll have that conversation coming up. But first, pro-Palestinian protests on U.S. college campuses entering their second week. Several protesters were arrested at the University of Texas in Austin, but school officials say most of them are not believed to be affiliated with the university. Here in Georgia, the president of Emory University is walking back a statement that said protesters were not part of the school's community. That president is facing a no-confidence vote from the school's faculty. And at Columbia University in New York, the epicenter for this movement, the school's deadline for protesters to disband has now expired. The demonstrators voted to defy the order, and Columbia says it has now begun suspending those who are refusing to leave the campuses. Well, I'm joined now by CNN security correspondent Josh Campbell for more on all of this. Good to see you, Josh. So we've seen a range of responses to these protests. We've seen situations where there's no outside police. We've seen heavily armed police and also very violent arrests. But certainly in Colombia, it's almost 6 hours since that deadline expired for protesters there to leave the encampment or face suspension. What are authorities weighing there with their response?
Yeah, Linda, that posture of law enforcement and the university at Columbia, much different than we're seeing in other places, such as the University of Texas today, such as Emory University in the last few days. And as you mentioned, the authorities, officials at the university gave this 2 p.m. deadline today for essentially this group of protesters who had set up an encampment to disperse. Now, the penalty that they were weighing here includes academic discipline, including suspending students who were on campus. Again, that is much different than what we've seen in other places where individuals on campus have actually been criminally charged for trespassing. And I think that comes down to officials there wanting to potentially de-escalate this situation, not ratchet it up, send police onto that campus in order to clear it. But of course, there is the big question about what comes next. These protesters have indicated they're not going anywhere. We saw several groups calling on others to join today to surge to the campus in order to, quote, protect the encampment. And so it's just a matter of time whether officials there actually determine that they want to bring in the NYPD, New York Police, in order to clear that area. Of course, as all this has been going on, we've also been hearing from Jewish students there on campus who say that they don't feel safe. One anonymous student filed a lawsuit in federal court today, essentially accusing the university of unfair practices and having students now dial in remotely for classes. And of course, again, we've heard from so many students saying that some of the protests themselves are making them unsafe and not lending themselves to a safe environment in order to get an education. So certainly a volatile situation right now, not a surge of police onto the campus, but we're all waiting to see what authorities ultimately do, Linda.
And of course, Josh, the stakes are high. We've already seen the resignations of two presidents at various universities for failing to contain anti-Semitism, and also calls now for the president of Emory to step down for those violent arrests we saw last week. How unusual is it for a college campus to call outside police in to deal with any sort of protest like this?
Well, you hope that would be the final step, right, to try to get these groups to disperse, to have these ongoing discussions. Again, college campuses in the United States have long been known as places where people come to demonstrate, where people can discuss views that they might have, even controversial views. Of course, the question here has come down to a lot of harassment that people have claimed on these campuses, some anti-Semitic material and slogans by some of the protesters. And we've seen, such as at the University of Texas today, authorities come in very with a full show of force in order to try to dismantle a makeshift camp that was set up there in the center of campus. Now, you know, I've talked to law enforcement across the country often. One thing that I'm hearing now from law enforcement is they don't want to be in the middle of any of this, right? Regardless of what a view one holds as far as the Israeli Hamas ongoing war, the role of the police is simply to clear out trespassers. You know, there's no First Amendment right in the U.S. to protest on private property, and authorities are essentially taking their cue from the university. Whenever university administrators and university boards of directors say, we want these areas cleared, these people are trespassing, the police have to go in just as they would at any type of business or property. But it certainly presents a precarious situation when you have protesters who say that we're not going anywhere. We saw a number of people detained today at the University of Texas, that ongoing right now, trying to clear out that camp. And so again, you would hope that would be a last resort to bring in law enforcement, but we're certainly seeing it happen across the country.
And it's interesting, the tense scenes that we saw last week seem to have only led to the expansion and the intensification of these protests across the U.S. But it's interesting, Joss, when you look at the polling, most Americans don't approve of Israel's war in Gaza, its handling of its war in Gaza. So it must make it harder, really, for some of these colleges to toe the line to handle these sorts of demonstrations.
No, it is a really great point. When you look at public opinion and public sentiment, and, you know, as we've discussed, college campuses are areas where people are there to discuss their views, even the views that might be in conflict and that are certainly controversial. And so I think that's why we're seeing some universities take a softer approach when it comes to actually clearing out areas. Because as you mentioned, you know, this is an issue that has certainly has garnered widespread attention in the U.S. There's been widespread condemnation of the number of innocent deaths that we've seen in Gaza. And so it's certainly something that has served as a catalyst, people taking to the streets here in the U.S., particularly at universities and college campuses. But again, I think the big question for the universities come down to how do they balance that with also the need to protect the safety of students and to ensure, you know, a campus where people are free from fear. And we've just heard so many times now in the last several days where Jewish students in particular are saying that, look, we signed up to come to this college campus to get an education, not to be berated and have to, you know, be exposed to a lot of these slogans and things that we've heard, you know, spraying of swastikas on certain pieces of property and the like. And so that is the delicate balance that administrators are doing right now. Despite the public sentiment, how do they create a campus that's free from hate? Worth pointing out that the overwhelming majority of these protests are indeed peaceful, and we have not seen that type of vitriol, but it has certainly been there in certain cases. And that's what the officials at universities are grappling with, Linda.
All right, Josh Campbell for us. Good to get your analysis of the situation. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Always. Thanks.
Well, Nick Valencia is at Emory University in Atlanta. Of course, Nick, this was the scene of those violent arrests last Thursday. We've since heard these repeated calls for the president there to step down. What's the latest?
Yeah, much different scene of intensity, level of intensity from what we saw last week. Those violent arrests that took place with Georgia State Patrol invited on campus by the president of Emory University, as well as members of the Atlanta Police Department. And they descended on these protesters that were staged in an encampment in this quad just behind me. And they tackled some of these demonstrators, throwing them on the ground. 28 people in all were arrested, 20 of whom had connections to this university, including current students and even a professor, Carolyn Folan. She's an economics professor, a prominent voice here on campus for the students. She was taken into custody, had to spend the night in jail. And there was also the chair of the philosophy department here, Noelle McAfee. She was detained, given a citation, and released. I caught up with her earlier, and she was telling me about the feelings of some Jewish students here on campus who believe that this has become a hostile environment for them. And she pushed back on that, and she said she believed that these demonstrations actually were not against Judaism, but rather against the actions of Israel in Gaza. We also caught up with one of those that was arrested who was a student here, Madeline Gordon. She's a senior here, and she says that she felt abandoned by the school's leadership, that she was protesting respectfully when police showed up and started in with the violence.
Students are out here because they don't want violence happening to anyone. It just feels really helpless as a young person when the people in authority and the people who are supposed to be like teaching you and leading you and showing you how to create a better world are like actively suppressing students.
All of this is being held, happening, as a referendum is being held on the university president. A ballot was handed out to the faculty here at the College of Letters of Arts and Sciences. And really, it's a no-confidence vote, a motion that was organized by the tenured faculty here last week, and it's now being put to the rest of the faculty here. It's a symbolic referendum to show that the university faculty has voted overwhelmingly at this point so far to say that not only did they not agree the way things were handled here on Thursday, but they have no confidence in the current university president to continue on here as a leader. Meanwhile, those days of action continue here. We had a 12 p.m. walkout by the faculty and then another 2:30 student-led demonstration. The crowd here that you can see behind me, they're the leftovers from that demonstration. Their protest continues here on Emory, but a very respectful one so far. Linda.
And of course, Nick, we know some students at college campuses are facing the threat of suspension should they continue with the protest, like at Columbia. Are there any repercussions for students there that have been arrested?
It's been of about face here. They've been charged, some with disorderly conduct, others with not dispersing when police told them to disperse, criminal trespassing. But really, there's been sort of an about face from university officials. They've actually been negotiating with defense attorneys, it's our understanding, and they're talking about actually dropping the charges of those who were arrested last week. We have yet to see that play out just yet, but those are the conversations that are happening. Meanwhile, as I mentioned, those days of action continue here on campus. In a much quieter fashion. Linda.
All right, Nick Valencia, good to have you on the story for us at Emory University in Atlanta. Thanks so much. We turn now to breaking news. Three U.S. Marshal officers have been shot and killed in Charlotte, North Carolina. Police say the officers were met with gunfire while serving a warrant for a firearm violation. One suspect was also killed while two other people are being held for questioning. Five other law enforcement officers were shot and injured during that incident. Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Chief Johnny Jennings explained what happened a short time ago.
About 1:30 p.m. this afternoon, the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force went to the 5,000 block of Galway Avenue in an attempt to serve a warrant on an individual for possession of firearm by a convicted felon. When they approached that individual, they were met with gunfire. Officers returned gunfire and struck the victim, who was later pronounced deceased in the front yard of the residence. As officers approached that individual, they then received additional gunfire from inside of the residence. So after a long standoff, we were able to clear this residence and confirm that there were two additional people inside. They were both brought to the police station as persons of interest, and we're trying to determine now what exactly occurred inside of the residence.
Our thoughts are certainly with the families of those three officers. We will have more on that story as it comes to hand. We're going to take a quick break. We'll have more from First Move in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back. Returning to our top story now, and pro-Palestinian protests are rocking college campuses right across the United States. Protesters at Columbia voted to remain at their encampment past the school's 2 p.m. deadline. The school says it has started suspending those who refuse to leave. And in Los Angeles, students at UCLA entered the university's main auditorium Monday afternoon while faculty held a rally in support. And at least six demonstrators were arrested at the University of Texas in Austin after officers moved in and surrounded a group of them. Well, the campus protests are just the latest political headache for U.S. President Biden. A new CNN poll shows that 71% of Americans disapprove of his handling of the Israel-Hamas war. That includes 81% of people under the age of 35. President Biden will likely need to carry young voters if he wants to win this November. Well, as President Biden faces these challenges, could some voters be remembering Donald Trump's presidency in a warmer light? That's what Stephen Collinson recently wrote about for CNN.com, and he joins us now live from D.C. Good to see you, Stephen.
Hi.
So are voters suffering from memory loss, failing to recall Trump's presidential term, or is it more big issues at play? The fact that, you know, Biden's response to Israel's war in Gaza is costing him, and Trump's ability to paint himself as this, you know, political victim is actually paying dividends for him.
Yeah, it seems strange that after a presidency that was 4 years of absolute chaos every day, that included two impeachments, that voters might be starting to feel a little bit more warmly about Donald Trump. History does show that the longer a president is out of office, the more voters appear to approve of his presidency. And I think what's going on here is that President Biden is the incumbent. Whenever there is something that voters are dissatisfied about, the guy in the Oval Office tends to get the blame, even if it's always not their fault. So we know that there's a great deal of discomfort still among voters about the economy, about high prices, about the impact of high interest rates, which are still not going down, that makes it hard to buy a house, to buy a car, etc. A lot of this is coming to build opposition against President Biden. And I think that is why voters might be saying, at least some of them, that their economic conditions before the pandemic were better when Trump was president than when Biden was president. But we've still got 6 months to go. And I think Biden will be trying to recreate those memories of the chaos of the Trump years for voters.
Yeah, he's certainly got an uphill battle to do that, especially when you consider how little interest there is in this 2016 rematch. That recent NBC poll found that interest in this election is at a 20-year low. It seems voters overall don't seem passionate about either candidate.
Yeah, and I think that is not particularly surprising, because if you go out and talk to voters at a lot of the rallies that took place, especially during the primary race, although you get your partisans that are in favor of Biden or Trump, a lot of voters aren't really excited by a contest between an 81-year-old incumbent, a 77-year-old who was already president. I think if there was another candidate, a younger candidate, pushing more to the future, that would, I think, get a lot more voters interested in the race. At the same time, however, Trump does have a record of turning out large numbers of base Republican voters who are excited to vote for him. He also has a record of stirring turnout among Democrats who despise him and really don't want him back as president. I think in a lot of ways, this race, although it is a referendum on the Biden presidency, the closer we get, the question is going to become to a lot of Americans, do they really want Donald Trump back? And as November approaches, it's going to be a little bit easier, I think, for Biden to make that contrast as we see Trump, you know, in the public eye more often, especially if there are debates and we get through the convention season and everything else. So while there's low interest now, I would expect it to tick up as we get closer to the election.
Yeah, as you say, still 6 months to go to November. Stephen Collinson, good to have you with us. Thanks.
Thanks.
Well, in today's money move, U.S. stocks began a busy week for economic data in the green. Call it the calm before the storm, with a Fed policy meeting beginning Tuesday and the monthly U.S. jobs numbers coming in on Friday. Important earnings also on tap from Apple and Amazon. Well, Tesla was one of the session's biggest winners. It rallied 15% on word that it's closer to winning approval in China for its advanced driver assistance technology. Asia also in the green, the Japanese yen strengthened as well. Traders suspect that officials in Tokyo gave the yen some much-needed support after it hit 34-year lows. Well, the Beijing Auto Show is all about electric vehicles this year, and that might explain why Tesla CEO Elon Musk made a surprise visit and met with senior trade officials. He was also there to promote Tesla's self-driving technology. And CNN's Mark Stewart was at the Auto Show and filed this report.
This is Auto China, the largest car show in all of China and one of the largest in the world. There are a few gas-powered cars here, but the real focus is electric.
I came here mainly checking on EVs. Now there are many EV brands, so there are lots of options.
We like the standout, eye-catching color.
There are more than 200 EV makers in China. Take a look over here. This is the line to see the latest offering from Xiaomi. It's a Chinese tech company known for its phones. This is the much talked about Xiaomi SU7. Yes, it has an aerodynamic design. It can accelerate very quickly. Its battery can take you for about 500 miles. But its most distinct point is this touchscreen. You can use it to control almost all aspects of your life. You can turn the lights in your home on and off. It can even start the coffee maker. This isn't just about performance. Geopolitics plays a role too. Elon Musk flew to China over the weekend on a surprise trip and met Chinese Premier Li Qiang. Musk has his biggest overseas Tesla factory in Shanghai, so he has big stakes in China. According to state media, Li said that China is open to foreign business and wants to make it easier for global companies to come here. In addition, Musk said Tesla's Gigafactory in Shanghai is its best performing. Tesla wants to be an even bigger player in the Chinese market in addition to its American base.
It's good to see electric vehicles making progress in China. All cars will be electric in the future.
As a piece of American technology, Tesla faced lots of restrictions in China out of security concerns. Until this visit, Tesla cars were sometimes not allowed to enter airports, government compounds, and other sensitive areas. Well, this time, after Musk met Li, Chinese authorities announced that such restrictions on Tesla cars are no more because the company's China-made vehicles have passed the country's data security requirements. As Elon Musk looks for success here in China, for Chinese car makers looking to break into the American market, that may not be so easy. Top U.S. officials have expressed concern that Chinese cars could potentially collect data and send it back here to Beijing, a potential blow for China, the world's largest auto exporter. Mark Stewart, CNN, Beijing.
Well, Oklahoma was hit by almost two dozen tornadoes Saturday, killing at least four people. Severe storms brought twisters and heavy rain from Missouri to Texas over the weekend. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Chad Myers. Good to have you with us, Chad. So these tornadoes certainly left a trail of devastation.
Right. More than 140. We're still counting. There likely could be 150 tornadoes that were on the ground over the past 3 days. Wind damage and hail damage as well. But here's one of the storms near where actually I went to college, near Lincoln, Nebraska, right here. This was a 150 plus mile per hour storm, 250 kph storm in its circulation down here right at the base, tearing up even some train cars there. This is the storm that was out of Oklahoma, doing devastation down here. So yes, some of these storms were approaching 280 kilometers per hour at the base. Things have calmed down today. We are in good shape. There will be a threat of some severe weather tomorrow. but not like that. Not like the pictures that I just showed you. There will be some hail, there may be some wind damage, but not the huge threat of monster tornadoes like we had across parts of the U.S. over the weekend. Someplace else that had some big weather, China. You don't see this very often. Look at the pictures here. Here's a tornado out of China. This thing is going to hit the power line structure, causing power flashes here with all of this debris in the air spinning around the storm. What else did it bring? Hail. Hail larger than baseballs, smashing the ground, smashing the cars, and even smashing through some roofs across parts of China. So yes, more rain is on the way. We do know that some spots will pick up another 250 millimeters of rain. Remember, we did that all that math over the last week. That's about 10 inches of rain just in the next 4 days. People here are sick of the rain. And really, if we get much more, there is going to be substantial flooding possible here, Linda.
Wow, incredible, and certainly frightening seeing the size of that hail. Chad Myers, good to have you with us. Thank you. We're going to take a quick break. We will have much more on First Move in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move. I'm Linda Kincaid with a look at more international headlines this hour. And Hamas is considering a proposal that calls for the group to release at least 20 Israeli hostages in exchange for a pause in the fighting. That number could go up to 33, according to our sources. And while visiting Saudi Arabia, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged Hamas to accept the offer.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. They have to decide, and they have to decide quickly. I'm hopeful that they will make the right decision and we can have a fundamental change in the dynamic.
In Gaza, officials in the Rafah hospital say at least 22 people, including 5 children, were killed in Israeli airstrikes on Monday. Hunter Biden is demanding Fox News remove sexually explicit images of him from its platforms. That's according to a letter obtained by CNN. Fox aired a mock trial of the U.S. president's son in 2022, which included explicit images. Biden says the images were hacked, with his attorneys alleging they violate state revenge porn laws. The Paris prosecutor's office says actor Gerard Depardieu will face trial in October over sexual assaults allegedly committed on a movie set back in 2021. He is also under investigation for suspected rape and sexual assault in another case dating from 2018. CNN has reached out to the French actor's lawyer for comment. Spain's prime minister says he will not resign after a far-right organization accused his wife of corruption. Pedro Sanchez canceled his public duties last week, saying he needed to reflect on whether he should stay on. A regional court has opened an investigation against his wife for alleged influence peddling. Returning now to our top story this hour, and protests at university campuses across the U.S. Several institutions have called in police to crack down on these demonstrations and remove tents. At Columbia University in New York, the epicenter for this movement, the deadline for protesters to leave expired 6 hours ago. Demonstrators voted to defy that order, and Columbia has started to suspend those who choose to stay in that encampment. But to get broader perspective on this, I want to bring in retired New York police detective and law enforcement consultant Tom Verney. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So we know, you know, for decades now, university students have protested and stood up for what they believe in. And certainly when it comes to Columbia University, it has a very long history of doing just that. What do you make of the police response so far, given that this 2 p.m. deadline is now passed and those encampments largely remain?
Well, this is a very, this is a very convoluted situation that we're dealing with here. It's very, very, very strong feelings on all sides of this issue. And, college students many of them live in an idealistic sort of frame of mind where they think that by interrupting campus operations or closing down a bridge or a tunnel is going to suddenly, make the world correct. And unfortunately, that's not how it goes. You know, while the police, ironically, are there to protect the rights of students to protest legally. Because inevitably, when you have a protest, you have anti-protesters, right? So, you know, the police are there to keep the peace, to make sure that those who are protesting can do so without feeling, you know, intimidated by those who are protesting against them, right?
I was just going to say, Tom, we have seen plenty of examples like that, but certainly there are also the examples like the one here at Emory University in Atlanta, where we saw some aggressive, violent arrests, really, with, you know, professors thrown to the ground. Is that the right way for police to respond to a demonstration like this?
Well, you know, demonstrations have a very high degree of probability of spinning out of control and turning into mini riots, you know, if cooler heads don't prevail. Many of them, many times, there are anarchists that participate in these protests who try to rile up the crowd and make the crowd go against the police. And, you know, when the police are giving lawful orders to perhaps move in a direction or to clear an area, whatever it may be, you know, the protesters have to comply with the lawful orders of the police. When they don't do that, then the police have to make a decision as to how they're going to potentially surgically remove those who are disrupting that peaceful protest, trying to turn it into something else and potentially put them at harm. You know, if the police are in harm's way, then who's going to protect the police and the general public, for that matter, if these protests get out of control? These protests are very large in numbers, many times, hundreds, if not thousands of people. So you have to try to ensure that they stay confined to the protest itself in a legal manner before things get out of control and somebody gets hurt or potentially killed.
There certainly have been instances of outside agitators, people that are not students nor faculty, protesting on campuses. How does law enforcement detect a so-called outside agitator, especially in a campus situation where there are barricades erected?
It's very difficult many times to do that. Some of them disguise themselves as part of the campus population. So it's not until their behavior draws the attention of the police in a certain way where it seems clear that their focus is not for the actual protest and what the protesters want. They try to gain or garner support amongst those who are agitated about the general situation, but now try to turn things against the college itself or try to turn things against the police and make the group agitated towards them and looking for some sort of uprising. This happened actually during about a dozen years or so ago when there was the Occupy Wall Street factions, if you recall, in lower Manhattan. You know, they took over a park called Zuccotti Park. They first started protesting about, you know, the banks and the bailing out of financial institutions during the great crash in 2008. And quite frankly, there were a number of police who were on board with that, saying, yeah, that is kind of messed up that these financial institutions are not being, you know, paid for with our tax money. And no one seems to have been punished for the wrongdoing of that. So, you know, when it started off with that core group of people protesting, it then sort of multiplied into all kinds of different protests, including those who are anti-government, those who are anti-police. It became 52 different protests in one. And then they decide to just camp out on someone's property. And that doesn't work well, you know, for too long either. So at some point they need to be removed off of private property.
Yeah, it's certainly a fragile situation trying to balance the rights of freedom of expression, the right to protest, the right to free speech, etc., while also maintaining safety and security. Good to have you with us, former New York Police Detective Tom Vermey.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the U.S. State Department is accusing five Israeli security units of human rights violations well before the start of the current war with Hamas. Four of those units have since taken action to address the claims. That's according to a State Department spokesperson. But U.S. officials are still weighing their response to the remaining unit. Kylie Atwood reports.
The State Department announced today that they have found five Israeli security units to have been in violation of gross human rights abuses for incidents that occurred before October 7th. But all of these units are still eligible to receive U.S. arms. And here's the breakdown of how this looks right now. Four of those units, according to the State Department, the Israelis have taken remediation action. We don't know exactly what that looks like, but presumably that's some sort of punishment for those who are involved with those human rights abuses. And then there is one unit. This is an IDF unit that the United States is still in talks with the Israelis over. The Israelis have provided more information to the United States about this incident or this unit. Presumably that was recently, though the State Department hasn't said exactly when that was, because that information is still being reviewed as the State Department is going to make its final determination as to whether this unit is still eligible to receive U.S. arms. It's noteworthy that State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel said earlier today that remediation for the Leahy Act, which is the requirement for the review of any of foreign actors or foreign governments who are receiving U.S. arms, that actual remediation is consistent across the board. But then when asked to describe what that actual remediation looks like, he said it is different on a country-by-country basis, pointing out that the U.S.-Israeli relationship is a very close one. So it's very clear that even though the State Department says that remediation is consistent, there are some irregularities, there's some different applications when it comes to different countries, and that is something that we are keeping an eye on as we watch to see the final decision over this IDF unit. Linda?
Oh, thanks to Kylie Atwood reporting there. We're going to take a quick break. Much more on First Move in just a moment.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
We return now to the breaking news out of North Carolina, where three members of U.S. Marshals Task Force have been shot and killed in Charlotte, North Carolina. Police say the officers were met with gunfire while serving a warrant for a firearm violation. One suspect was killed and two people are being held for questioning. Five other law enforcement officers were shot and injured during that incident. Diane Gallagher is standing by for us, and this is certainly a horrific tragedy, Diane. Three officers dead, five wounded while serving a warrant. What more can you tell us?
That's right. The chief of police saying that he can't recall a deadlier day in law enforcement here in the Charlotte area. Eight law enforcement officers shot, of course, three of them killed. The U.S. Marshals confirming one of those three, a deputy U.S. Marshal. Look, this started off with the execution of a warrant. They were serving a warrant on a suspect for felony possession of a firearm. According to the police, when that task force arrived, they were shot at. They returned fire and they shot that suspect who was pronounced dead on the front lawn of the home. Now, according to the chief, as they began going up to that suspect who had been shot, they began having gunshots come out of the house. CMPD, Charlotte Mecklenburg police officers, then responded. Four of those officers were injured who responded to the initial gunfire there. The mayor of Charlotte saying that she heard from the White House today, several members of Congress offering help and just expressing how tragic this was and how difficult it is for those here in this community to sort of comprehend what happened here.
You never know what your day is going to be like. You can't plan things like this to be in this space at this time. We've lost three people. They lost their lives after they gave us the opportunity to be in a safe place, and they lost their lives. These are people that care deeply about what they've done for a profession, and now today we have to say to them how much we are grateful for what they have done.
Now, we do know one of those police officers who was injured responding to the shooting remains in critical condition. The governor of North Carolina is here in the city of Charlotte. I'm told just now by his office that he'll be meeting with the victims and their families in just a few moments.
All right, Diane Gallagher, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks very much. We're going to take a quick break, but still ahead, unlocking Africa's limitless potential. Global Citizen and Bridgewater Associates are announcing a major African economic summit for later this year to help boost the continent's growth. We hear from the heads of both organizations after the break. Stay with us. You're watching CNN. Welcome back. I'm Linda Kincaid. In Nairobi, Kenya, on Monday, leaders from nearly 20 African nations met to discuss how best to rev up economic development, alleviate poverty, and help protect people from worsening climate change. At the event, hedge fund giant Bridgewater Associates and the Global Citizen organization announced a two-day economic summit in the Ivory Coast later this year. And that meeting will focus on helping the World Bank improve living conditions in 75 low-income countries. Well, I spoke today with Hugh Evans, the CEO of Global Citizen, as well as Bridgewater CEO Nia Bardia and Sela Bogonko, representing the Youth of Africa. All three were in attendance at the Nairobi conference. And I began by asking Hugh about the goal of October's summit and this new public-private partnership.
For the last 12 months, the team at Bridgewater, headed by Nia and I, have been meeting with many African heads of state, including the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, the president of Ghana, Akufo-Addo, president of Malawi, Chakwera, and so many others. And through all of these conversations, again and again, it's highlighted the urgent need for the public sector to invest more in the development of the African continent to help catch up to the future dividend that's going to take place as you see a major growth in population that's going to occur over the next 30 years on the continent. And with that background, we decided to support the World Bank's IDA replenishment. And that's why today at President Ruto's Africa Heads of State Summit here in Nairobi, Kenya, Global Citizen and Bridgewater Associates, in partnership with the government of Cote d'Ivoire and Harith General Partners, announced our economic summit. This is a two-day summit that we're going to be hosting on October 9th and 10th in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire, bringing together heads of state, finance ministers, leaders in civil society, all with one goal, calling on the G20 to increase their investment to support the World Bank's IDA fund by an additional 25%, which would account for more than $6 billion in new financing to help alleviate poverty across the continent.
It's certainly a huge goal, significant aim. To you, Nia, what can Bridgewater bring to this partnership? You're known for research. What can you bring to ensure that every dollar is spent wisely, both on a micro and macro level?
There's the announcement we made here today in Nairobi. But if you just take a step backwards, Bridgewater for almost 50 years has been mapping out the cause-effect linkages that underpin economies and markets. This includes short-term drivers, like whether the Fed is going to tighten or not, but very, very importantly, long-term drivers. On the day-to-day, we use this to advise, to give advice to our clients and to manage portfolios, but very, very importantly, we can also use that understanding of what the future might look like in order to help policymakers make great decisions. And one of the more important changes that is happening in the world today is happening here in Africa. And it's going to be very consequential to what the world is going to look like over the next 50 years. If I can just say two more things about that, just to make it tangible. Today, an eighth of the world's working age population lives in sub-Saharan Africa. That's a little under 700 million people. But Africa is going through a demographic boom. It's growing by about 30% each decade. And that's happening at the same time where population is basically declining in almost every other place in the world. So that means that in the coming future, three quarters of the population growth in the globe is going to come here from the continent, which will result in a third of the population, the working age population, being here in Africa in about 50 years, in our lifetime. And that's a big deal. And that means that Africa is going to have a huge, huge levered effect on the entire world. This could really activate a ton of untapped human potential, like the ones that we've seen, by the way, in other regions over the last 50 years. But if that doesn't happen and there's no productivity boom and we just continue on the current path, there's a real chance that this is going to be destabilizing, not just for the continent, but the entire world. And just imagine so many people in the continent in the most critical age bracket in a region, by the way, that's most impacted by climate change. We're in Nairobi right now. There's a climate disaster happening right now in Nairobi. People are not talking about it enough. There was one that was happening in Malawi not long ago.
And to Hugh's point earlier, this is all part of fundraising for the World Bank's International Development Association. And I want to ask you about this, Sela, because you can speak firsthand to the impact of that group. Just explain what you've witnessed in your time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Linda. I absolutely agree with Hugh and Mia, because what we are facing is a huge opportunity on the one hand, but another huge challenge on the other hand. As mentioned just now, the fact that we have a quarter of the population on the world in 2050 is going to be African. And then by 2075, we're going to have a third of the population that is working age and working class, being from Africa, means that we need to begin to make those investments right now. There's quite a bit of funding that is available, but it needs to be channeled in the right directions. And it's true that we do need to raise the ambition in terms of the amount of money that is being raised for the continent, because we have a lot of opportunity to be able to skill some of the workforce on the continent. For example, in the renewable energy space in Africa, we have 50% of the world's renewable energy potential, but then you only have 2% of the investment flowing into the continent, meaning that we need to raise a lot more money that would then flow into the continent to be able to address the globe's demand when it comes to energy. We have 60% of the world's arable land, and we have opportunity to create jobs around agriculture, tourism, energy, and many others, even in the digital space. But we do need to be a bit more strategic as leaders in Africa, even as we ramp up as donors and as we ramp up the investment into the continent. And we could not be working, you know, with better partners, with the likes of Global Citizens and Bridgewaters, who are raising the awareness around the need, but more important, the potential and the demand and the requirement to be able to create more and better jobs for the African youth.
Our thanks there to Sela, Hugh and Nia. Well, finally, on First Move, let's turn our attention to entertainment news before we go. The players are going to play, and so are the fans, millions and millions of times over. And for a fortnight there, we were forever running to you sometimes. Ask about whoever now. The unmistakable sound of Taylor Swift there with Post Malone performing their number one hit, Fortnite. Well, Swift is again shattering records left and right. She occupies the top 14 spots on the Billboard Hot 100. The Tortured Poets Department is also her 14th number one album here in the US, the highest for any female solo artist. Well, that just about wraps up our show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Linda Kincaid. I'll see you back here same time tomorrow.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.